Shortly after 9/11, the Pentagon ordered a top-secret team of American commandos into Afghanistan with a single, simple order: kill Osama bin Laden. It was America's best chance to eliminate the leader of Al-Qaeda. The inside story of exactly what happened in that mission and how close it came to its objective has never been told until tonight. The man you're about to meet was the officer in command, leading a team from the U.S. Army's mysterious, a unit so secret, it's often said that doesn't exist. But you're about to see operators in action. Why would the mission commander break his silence after 7 years? He told us that most everything he's read in the media is wrong. And tonight, he wants to set the record straight.
Our job is to go find him, capture, kill him. And we knew the writing on the wall was really to kill him. No one wanted to bring Osama bin Laden back to stand trial in the United States anymore.
In 2001, just 10 weeks after 9/11, he was a 37-year-old Army major leading a team of America's most elite commandos. Even now, we can't tell you his name or show you his face. We hired a theatrical makeup artist to take the former officer through a series of transformations to create the man you see now. He calls himself Dalton Fury. He's the author of Kill Bin Laden, a new book out this week. Dalton Fury is used to disguises. In fact, in 2001, his entire team transformed itself in Afghanistan.
Everybody has their beard grown. Everybody's wearing local Afghan clothing, sometimes carrying the same weapons as them.
The idea was that if this all worked out, Osama bin Laden would be dead, and no one would ever know that he was there.
That's right. That's the plan. And that always is when you're talking about.
And there was no mission more important to the United States.
We'll smoke him out of his cave, and we'll get him eventually.
Using radio intercepts and other intelligence, the CIA pinpointed bin Laden in the mountains near the border of Pakistan. Following the strategy of keeping an Afghan face on the war, Fury's team joined the CIA and Afghan fighters and piled into pickup trucks. They videotaped their journey to a place called Tora Bora. Fury told us his orders were to kill bin Laden and leave the body with the Afghans.
Right here, you're looking at basically the battlefield from the last location that we had for him on Osama bin Laden's location.
This ridge line is at about 14,000 feet, and back this way toward me is Pakistan.
That's right.
On a scale of, say, 1 to 10, 10 being the toughest, how tough a position is this to attack?
In my experience, it's a 10.
They developed an audacious plan to come at bin Laden from the one direction he would never expect.
We want to come in on the back door.
You were going to come up over the tops of the peaks?
That's right. The original plan that we sent up to our higher headquarters, of course, wants to come in over the mountain with oxygen, coming from the Pakistan side, over the mountain to come in and get a drop on bin Laden from behind.
Why didn't you do that?
Disapproved at some level above us. Whether that was Central Command or all the way up to the President of the United States, I'm not sure.
The military wouldn't tell us who rejected the plans or why. Fury wasn't happy about it, but he pressed on with the only option he had left, a frontal assault on bin Laden's dug-in Al-Qaeda fighters. The team had only about 50 men, so the mission would depend on the Afghan militia as guides and muscle. Their leader was a warlord, a self-styled general named Ali.
Ali told us, after about 30 seconds of discussion, he kind of listened to me ramble on, and then the first thing he said was, "I don't think you guys can handle it. You can't handle Al-Qaeda in these mountains."
Ali, second from the left, met with this CIA officer and accepted millions of dollars in cash from the agency. In short order, his Mujahideen fighters were escorting force into the mountains. Dressed like Afghans, the Americans maneuvered up the mountains, calling in airstrikes on Al-Qaeda. By day, they would advance, but at night, they soon discovered that their Afghan allies went home.
Well, I have to assume that if you started up the hills of Tora Bora and the Mujahideen took territory, they didn't abandon that at night.
Oh, yes, they did.
They gave it up to the enemy?
Absolutely. Mujahideen would go up, get into a skirmish, firefight, lose a guy or two, maybe kill an Al-Qaeda guy or two, and then they leave. It was almost like it was an agreement and understanding between the two forces fighting each other. Almost put on a good show and then leave.
4 days after arriving in Tora Bora, Dalton Fury was faced with a fateful command decision. Three of his men were in trouble behind enemy lines, and at the same time, the CIA had been listening to bin Laden's radio transmissions and had a breakthrough.
And this is where it gets complicated. At about the same time, the CIA, George, comes into our room and he says, "Guys, I got a location for Osama bin Laden. That's probably the best location of that we've had on this Osama bin Laden ever."
It was night, so Fury was without his Afghan allies. Still, he managed to rescue his men and then found himself approaching bin Laden's doorstep.
We're about 2,000 meters away from where we think bin Laden's at still, from where we're at. Now we have to make a decision.
Fury had two choices: advance his small team with no Afghan support or return to camp and assault in the morning. He was under orders to make the Afghans take the lead, and intelligence said there were more than 1,000 hardened fighters protecting bin Laden.
You write in the book, "My decision to abort that effort to kill or capture bin Laden when we might have been within 2,000 meters of him, about 2,000 yards, still bothers me. It leaves me with the feeling of somehow letting down our nation at a critical time."
That's correct.
Why do you feel that way?
Had we gone up that ridgeline towards that location, Osama bin Laden might have been 500 meters away. We might have run right into him. So there's always that doubt that we might have run into him. We also might have got up there and found nothing. It wasn't worth the risk at that particular moment to go up there and play cowboy. It was better to be cautious, refit, go up there with the entire force the next day, and play the battle out as we had planned.
In the morning, bin Laden was on the radio. The CIA, and their Afghan allies were listening.
How did the Afghans react
when they heard from Osama bin Laden on the radio?
Osama bin Laden is many a Muslim's hero. These guys, in my opinion, were more in awe of Osama bin Laden than they were willing to kill him. When they heard him talking on the radio, they would gather around the individual that held that handheld transistor. He would hold it up in the air, almost as if he didn't want the connection to break. It's almost like they could see the ridgeline Osama bin Laden happened to be talking from, like they could almost see him and feel his presence. And they just stood there with wide eyes and somewhat in awe that here is a leader of the jihad, the leader of Al-Qaeda, and they're actually hearing his voice over the radio.
And these were the men who were supposed to help you capture or kill him. Some allies.
Some were better than others.
Welcome to the Global Recon Podcast. I'm your host, John Hendricks. I have a special guest on with me for this episode, Jamie Caldwell. And Jamie served in the United States military for several years. We'll walk through a lot of that. Jamie, how's it going?
Good, man. How are you? I appreciate you having me on, man.
I'm doing well. You know, as I told you a couple of seconds ago, I just got back from a vacation, so I'm just kind of readjusting back into actually doing work and stuff like that, and not doing anything, you know.
Yeah, I hear you, man. You sounds like you took a multi-country trip. That is definitely an awesome vacation. But yeah, it's an adjustment getting back from all the time zones and just enjoying yourself. Now you got to get right back into work. So
right.
I don't envy that, but I'm glad I'm here. And we're hitting it off together, though. That's pretty cool, man. I appreciate you having me on and looking forward to this podcast, man.
So I would like to start with kind of walking through your career in the military. If we can start like from the beginning and what motivated you, and then sort of walk through it a little bit.
Yeah, man. So I guess from a young age, you know, just being a kid, you know, growing up in the 80s, you know, I was into, you know, being outside and being active like all kids, you know, that time frame, and just always playing like cops and robbers. And, you know, we used to do BB gun wars, you know, and then kind of paintball started. So, you know, doing that, but I just was always into that. My dad was a cop, So I was always around that. You know, my dad was a cop for about 35 years. So that, you know, a little bit, I guess, was kind of instilled me in that aspect. But I knew at a young age that, you know, the military was something that I liked. My grandfather had served in the Navy. He was in World War II as a fighter pilot on aircraft carriers, which was, yeah, pretty cool. So hearing a lot of his stories, and then my other grandfather was in the Army, the Air Force before it was the Air Force, so the Army Air Corps.
Oh, wow.
You know, he had served. Yeah, so a little bit of a history of it in my family. I had an uncle that was in Vietnam, and a great uncle that was in Korea, that was a Ranger in Korea, which was really cool. So I wanted to go into the military. I already knew it going into high school. Actually, little short funny story, but when I went to go see my career, my counselor or whatever, freshman year of high school, and they sort of set you on your path of your classes that you're going to take. I mean, he's all about, okay, we're going to get you signed up for your college prep stuff. And I'm like, nah. I was like, I'm not going to college. I was like, I'm going to the military when I get out of high school. And he's like, really? I'm like, yeah. I'm like, nope, that's what I'm going to do. So needless to say, he talked me into, just as a backup, I took all my college prep stuff I needed in high school. But I'd say right after my 18th birthday, my senior year, I enlisted. I did the delayed entry, enlisted into the Army. And I went in with a Ranger contract. So I kind of knew what I wanted. Initially, I actually wanted to be a SEAL. At the time, that was kind of the most high speed thing that I thought of that was out there. And then lucky for me, one of my older sisters happened to be dating a guy at the time that was at 1st Ranger Battalion earlier on in his career. And he kind of sat me down and, you know, kind of explained to me a little bit more of the different services and what, you know, special operations had to offer and certain paths I could take. And, he sold me on the Ranger route. And then, you know, and from there I could go SF or go to the unit or, you know, do whatever. I mean, it just opened up a lot of doors and I could go in, you know, sign up with a Ranger contract. So that's what I did. I signed up, got a Ranger contract and initially wanted, to go in as an infantry, 11 Bravo with that Ranger contract. But when I got to MEPS and basically, you know, ready to ship out when you're signing your contract stuff, they, you know, told me it wasn't available, but they had a communications. It was a 31 Charlie single channel radio operator contract, with Airborne and with Ranger. So I had no idea what that was. And the guy there behind the desk couldn't really tell me much either. So I ended up asking him, I'm like, hey, can I make a phone call? And he's like, yeah, I guess. So I left the room and I called my brother-in-law and, asked him about it. And he's like, oh, hey, yeah. He goes, no, take it. He's like, you'll actually learn a skill. You know, you'll have something that's useful later on in life. So I took that. So that's how I sort of started out. I went to Ranger Battalion. I ended up getting the 1st Ranger Battalion after I made it through Airborne and, Ranger selection, went to 1st Ranger Battalion down in Savannah, Georgia. And I was a commo guy there. And a few people have seen that and sort of commented on, some of my posts on Instagram on my 1 minute out page where I'm in like a Class A uniform and you can see the signal crest, on my Class A uniform. Some people have picked that out. I was a communications guy in a line company in Ranger Battalion, did that was there for about 7 years. And then, wanted to do more. I knew that there were other things out there and, I had actually met the, signal squadron major, the signal, sergeant major from signal squadron, about 6 months or so prior to, me moving out of Ranger Battalion, and he invited me up to come up, to the unit as a commo guy. And it was very interesting because I enjoyed the commo stuff. I mean, I've always been into the technology piece of everything. And, I ended up calling him up and, was looking at coming up there and he asked me one question. He said, we'd love to have you, think you'd be a great fit up here. He said, have you ever thought about being an operator? And I said, yeah, I thought about it. And he said, well, do me a favor. He says, go to selection first. He says, just try it. He goes, if it doesn't work out, he's like, I'll be on the board or I'll be there. He says, we'll grab you up in a heartbeat. And I'm like, all right. So I went through the whole process.
You mean to go, like, if even if you fail the selection, to go as a combo guy?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. So he basically said, hey, we'd love to take you as a combo guy up here as a support guy. But he said, if you even think, you know, or thought about, you know, wanting to be an operator, you know, just do me a favor and just go do that. And his reasoning was solid. And it was because if I even had that thought in the back of my mind, when I got up there as a support guy and saw that, you know, then he's afraid that he would spend all this time, you know, training me up and, you know, getting me to their level, you know, as a combo guy. And then I would say, hey, I'm going to selection now, and he'd lose me, you know, cause there's a, you know, we'll get into that later, but you know, there's a lot of guys in the building that are support guys. They come up there as support guys, medics, combo guys, whatever it is. And, you know, even we've, you know, had some guys that were cooks or, you know, whatever, and they decide, hey, you know what, I want to go for it. And they go to selection, and, you know, if they make it, then, you know, they no longer, you know, they're no longer a support guy there. They, you know, they made the process and now they're an operator.
Right.
So he was afraid that that may happen. And I totally respected that and said, yeah, you know, let me give it a shot. So I did, you know, went through that route, went to selection, made it. And, you know, I'm glad he, you know, kind of pushed me on that route first. But yeah, made it and, was at the unit for about right at like 14 years. And then, you know, ended up retiring out of there, retired out at 21 years and some change. And now just enjoying life, probably busier now than I was when I was in. But it's all good. It's everything I want to do now, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So you know, we you touched on selection a little bit. So I'd like to talk to you about it and, you know, what the preparation is like mentally for it. You know, what's the right attitude and what do you think is needed to succeed at the highest level of special operations or combat arms?
Right. It's a great question. And I get asked it a lot. I get a lot of guys that hit me up, you know, on Instagram Messenger and stuff like that are, you know, wanting to take a similar path and asking, you know, what can they do? Are they the right person? And, you know, it's weird. There is prep, you know, things that you can do to prep, to get ready. You know, there's obviously a big physical aspect to it, but it's a big mental aspect to it. And that's what's pretty neat, you know, overall about the unit is you walk down the hallway and, you know, there's such a wide range of people in that building, you know, doing different jobs, but especially as operators, you know, it's not the cookie cutter guy that most people think, you know, 6 foot bodybuilder, you know, just go get a hard charger type person. You know, there's a big range, you know, and I don't fit that mold at all. You know, I mean, I'm 5 foot nothing. You know, I mean, I work out quite a bit. I mean, I stay in shape, you have to. But yeah, it's different. And there's a lot more guys like me than there are of the big, you know, big muscle head type, 6 foot plus guys that you usually see portraying special ops guys in the movies. Not necessarily like that. But as far as prep goes, you know, you definitely need to be in great shape. You know, and there's things you can do to prep prior to going. And, you know, if you go through the briefing and, you know, you're serious about it, to someone out there that's looking for that path, when you go to the briefing and you talk to the recruiters, you know, they're going to give you everything that you need to succeed. They're going to tell, you know, give you a train up program and everything. And overall the course, you know, selection is set up, to, you know, to give you every opportunity to succeed. You know, we select from everywhere, you know, in the military, any service, any MOS, it doesn't matter. And, you know, we know that you're going to get guys showing up there that may not have looked at a map or done land navigation since basic training, you know, just different things. So it's a crawl, walk, run, course. And, you know, it's, I think it is the best course in the military, just by the way it's run, how professional it's run, and they give you every single tool, and they will teach you everything you need to know to be successful in that course. So, you know, you'll get everything that you need. You just have to come there with a good attitude, be in good shape, and don't quit. That's kind of the biggie. There's not really a special sauce for what somebody could give you or information. You could have all the information in the world, but if you're not the right person that they're looking for, then you're not the right person. That's kind of what it comes down to. There's no quota. There's no certain numbers that they need to meet. My class started with close to like 130 guys, and there was like maybe 20 of us at the end, just selection, that ended up making it through. And then you go to OTC, and then you lose guys in OTC. And there's some classes where there might only be one or two guys that graduate that finish, because those were the right one or two guys. That's it. I mean, my class, we had 8 that finished. That was it. And that's kind of low. But it varies every class. There's no certain number. It's the right guy. They pick the right guy for the job.
So you spoke about before, you kind of touched on there's a physical aspect, and then obviously it's mental, and you need to be the kind of the right person. But do you feel like you get to a point where it doesn't matter how good of a shape you're in, you have to mentally just be that person?
Oh yeah, big time. Yeah, if you could be in the best shape in the world, and that's only going to get you through the physical parts, but it's the mental piece that breaks people down. It's the bits of not knowing, and there's things that obviously just can't get into with the way selection is set up, but it will test you mentally, and it gets a lot of guys. It's just part of it is just the not knowing, and it's unique the way it's set up, because it's testing you there, but it's making sure that you're the right person, so that downrange, when you're off working in a foreign country, on your own doing things, that you're comfortable. You can't have a guy that's spazzing out. Take scuba school, for instance. You do all these elaborate drills underwater where they're, ripping your regulator out, you're blindfolded, and they're tying your hose in a knot. I mean, just these things that are conditioning you to stay calm in those situations. Understand that, okay, let me take a couple seconds, undo this mess, and then I'll get air again. I mean, it's the same thing, just kind of, mental process of being able to work in any environment, whether it's on your own or one other person, or being in different situations and being able to calmly think through, high risk scenarios and get yourself and your mates, through it and out of it, and have mission success.
Yeah. I think that, what you just said, that mentality, or that being trained in that way, where you just have to take a couple of seconds and walk through it versus panicking, I think that can kind of trickle down into all aspects of life, if you really think about it.
Oh yeah, definitely does. I mean, and you see, everybody has those friends that, doesn't matter what you're doing, you're out just having a good time, or you're, doing something, and that one dude that's just kind of wigs out about everything, and, has anxiety, has this, that going on. You're just like, man, that dude's a mess. I would not want to be downrange with that guy. So it's there's a lot of aspects to it overall, just being in special operations, but there's so many different levels of it. We're talking about the tip of the spear. There's a ton of awesome guys in Ranger Battalion, in SF, in the groups, in the SIFs, that are great guys. Some have tried out, not made it, some never try out. But they're great where they are, and those units are phenomenal. And that's why everybody has, there are different units, and everybody has a different mission set. you know, for what they do, because you have different caliber people in there. That's all.
So how long were you in the military before 9/11?
Right. About 8 years.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. About 7-8 years. I came in 93. I'm pretty much, I mean, I spent most all my time at Ranger Battalion, but once I got to the unit, which was in 2000, you know, then I finished up all my stuff there training wise and was operational, was, I mean, a couple months before 9/11 happened. It was a unique time, you know, for me and for, you know, the unit, for the world overall, but I mean, I hit it right at the right point. You know, my OTC class was the class, you know, we graduated right before 9/11, and that was it. I mean, the only thing that we knew was combat. You know, and I was fortunate because of that timing and being young, you know, on a team where, I mean, pretty much my whole career, I mean, it was just deployment, deployment, deployment. I mean, I did 14 deployments to combat over those 14 years that I was there.
And that was all with the unit?
Yes. Yep.
Okay, so I wanted to ask you, since you were at Tora Bora, where were you when the towers fell? Can you talk about that?
Yeah. We were at a JRX. I think I was in Turkey. Yeah, we were already forward deployed. We were at a JRX, and I remember we were just kind of chilling out, sitting in the tent, waiting, you know, to get a briefing and go. Actually, we were getting ready to go, you know, do some stuff that night. And one of the guys, you know, had a couple radios that were, you know, just hanging out in the tents, and we heard it come across the radio. And you know, we're like, what the heck is that? You know, obviously, like everybody, just confused on, wait, what's going on? You know, some local pilot just crashes, you know, his plane. How the heck that happened? And, you know, we kind of gather around, sitting around, and, you know, a bunch of us, and then we're sort of listening to, you know, go down. And then, you know, we slid over into the talk and start, you know, looking at the TVs. And yeah, it was like, holy cow. I mean, everything just, obviously, all the training, everything that was going on just got put on hold. And we had everything with us. So we were pretty much like, all right, hey, we're going right from here. You know, where are we going? What, let's start planning. I mean, where's our first target? What are we doing? I mean, we were ready to go. And, we ended up sitting there for, it felt like forever, but, I think we were there for at least 3 days or more till we did anything. Trying to figure everything out, figure out the moving pieces. And that, you know, was levels above us, just seeing who was going to go where and what we were doing. But we ended up flying back home. And another squadron went in first, and then we went in and relieved them. So I deployed in, I think it was October of that year. I deployed, we staged forward, and then ended up inserting into Afghanistan, and we pretty much set up Bagram. So we were kind of some of the first ones there. I mean, I remember initially getting there and us just kind of grabbing some ground, which we still own that area now. It's changed immensely, but I mean, I've got some different pictures from when we first got there, just being fields and some rubble buildings. And now it's elaborate, you know, barracks and all kinds of stuff there now. Cause I went back there. I mean, I was there in 01 was for that whole Christmas. We did a Christmas rotation. So 01, I was there October through sometime January, and then went back again, there in October of the following year. So that was awesome too. Christmas rotations back to back, but that's just kind of the way it worked out. I didn't go back to Afghanistan until 2010 or 11. and ended up making a trip back there to see everything. It was just like, wow. I mean, blown away at how much it had grown. And, you know, obviously we had expanded the little area where we were, but some of it still looked the same. So it was pretty neat to go back there and see it.
And when you guys first got there, it was a landing strip, right?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. It was a pretty bad landing strip. It was, you know, had been blown up partway, and there was a lot of like old Russian Hulks and tanks and, you know, MiGs. I mean, there was all kinds of stuff all over the place. Yeah, and landmines everywhere. Yeah, still.
Russian landmines.
Yeah, so it was treacherous. Yes. Yep. Yeah. It was treacherous. I mean, they had to come in with minesweepers, and actually an area that we, outside of one of the buildings that we were living in, where we had been walking through some dunnage and, you know, different kind of area we were sort of hanging out in during the day as we were figuring everything out. when we left and went to Tora Bora, they swept that whole area, and they ended up finding a couple mines like right in that area.
Wow.
Luckily none of us found them, but yeah, the mine sweeper and the equipment found them all.
Yeah, with the Russians, the mines that the Russians left, and then the Taliban and other groups there, you know, planting mm-hmm. IEDs and stuff like that, Afghanistan is the most mined country on the planet. So as dangerous as it is to get into gunfights and things like that, it's, I think more coalition troops have been killed by bombs in the ground rather actual mm-hmm. gunfights.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I don't doubt it. I mean, it is. There's a ton of them everywhere throughout that country. Yeah, it's a mess.
Okay, so I wanted to talk about Tora Bora. Were you there in the initial movement in, or did you rotate in there?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. No, I was there through the whole thing, and it didn't last all that long. I mean, for us specifically, like Tora Bora. I know there's other battles that happened in and around there, but the actual like Tora Bora piece, you know, and a lot of guys, if they want more, you know, more details, Dalton Fury, who was our troop commander at the time for all of that, he wrote a book on it, right. Killed Bin Laden, and if guys haven't read it, you know, and they're interested in it, there's a lot of details. It's a really good book. But yeah, so I was there initially. What we ended up doing was driving. We drove trucks, like Hiluxes, you know, Tacomas, from Bagram all the way to Jalalabad, and then from Jabad south into Tora Bora and up into, you know, as far as we could get in Tora Bora. We had to get dropped off at a certain point because it was just footpaths from there. We went into that area initially, staged at a local tribal chief's, we called it the schoolhouse, but his kind of house and building. And we sort of planned from there, and then we actually inserted twice. The very first time we had to turn around, we got turned around by the press. You know, it was pretty big for the locals and the local tribes, especially the guy that was kind of hosting us and provided us a couple guides, that there was no U.S. presence there. And there was a hill that you could see from where we were, but we called it Press Hill.
Right.
And it was littered with media. I mean, 24/7, because there was tons of like just different shelling and, you know, different stuff going on at the base of the mountains there in Tora Bora, and a lot of activity because that's where Bin Laden was. And, it was littered with press. And the first time that we tried inserting, you know, we were dressed in local garb and just kind of sitting in the back of the pickups and, you know, covered in, you know, some blankets and just sort of trying to blend in. And, we had to get through that area in order to get to where we had to go. And the first time we went through, we just got mobbed, and we ended up just turning around and coming back. And we inserted again the second time at night, and, you know, we're able to kind of get through there. But there was a couple pictures that leaked out of some guys, you know, sitting in the back of those trucks, and, you know, it was like, hey, is this Americans? I mean, yeah, it was some media stuff that people had to deal with other than us, but, yeah, it was kind of a pain in the butt. The press was a pain in the butt through the insertion, and then when we were coming out of Tora Bora too. But we inserted in, and and basically just chased Bin Laden. You know, we heard him on the radios. You know, we knew vicinity of his location. We knew where, you know, a bunch of troops were. So it was just continued, firefight. Not necessarily direct fire, but you know, calling in munitions just 24/7.
Yeah.
On these guys all up in the, you know, this huge mountain range, and just advancing forward and advancing through those positions and just keep taking ground. And, we had aircraft stacked. I mean, there were times that they were like stacked 10 high. I mean, coming from all over the world to just come in and drop bombs there. We dropped, I can't even tell you how much number wise or poundage wise, but it was just ungodly. I mean, how much we dropped there and how much we destroyed that place. It was crazy. But what's kind of neat, here's a little backstory. I think it's mentioned in the book, but this whole, like, you know, everybody sees this Molon Labe type thing, and it's sort of, I guess with this whole global war, everybody sort of adapted it and uses it, and you see it everywhere. But it's kind of personal to me and to us, because we went into that mountain range, and when we showed up at this schoolhouse with this tribal chief, he, you know, said to our leader, the guy that was, you know, to Tom Dalton Fury, that was working with him, you know, closely, meetings and everything every day. But he's like, where are the rest of your guys? And Tom's like, this is it. I mean, it was literally maybe 30 of us, maybe. And the tribal chief laughed at him. And he's like, what? He goes, you're going up into those mountains with 30 guys? He goes, there's 30,000 troops up there. And, you know, they know that land. They built that. They have caves, everything. They lived there. They fought the Russians there for years and years and defeated them. You're going to take 30 guys and go up there? He's like, well, I guess I'll be coming up to get your bodies, you know, tomorrow. I mean, he just was like, no way, you're not doing it.
Right.
And within hours of us being up there, you know, we have intercepted radio transmissions of all those foreign fighters and everybody just like screaming for help and just like, they're all over us. They're killing us left and right. I mean, we just annihilated that place. And it's, from that, we, as, you know, as a squadron from that whole battle of Tora Bora, kind of adopted Molon Labe as our squadron motto. Cause we were literally just few against thousands and went in and just destroyed them. You know, so it was a pretty neat, you know, piece of that whole Tora Bora battle, you know, that came out of that. Anyway, little side story, but it was fun. I mean, overall, it was grueling. You know, we were climbing. I mean, we got to over 8,000 feet at one point. The weather changed immensely. I mean, we were getting snowed on, and we packed fairly light. You know, I had a rucksack on my back, and you know, that was it. I mean, we didn't even have full sleeping bags. We didn't bring much up there, and it got to a point where we had to be resupplied. And a lot of guys know who Greg Birch is, but he was our squadron sergeant major at the time. Him and a few other guys ended up like walking all the way up to us at almost 8,000 feet, and they made like 3 trips up and back. Yeah. Within probably an 18 hour window, if that, and just brought us all supplies, like ended up bringing us sleeping bags, bringing us chow, water. I mean, they were humping some heavy, heavy loads up and down the mountain multiple times to resupply us up there.
That's crazy.
It was impressive. That was one of my first like whoa moments of Greg Birch. I mean, you know, there were stories and everything, and there still are. I mean, he's just an amazing individual. But yeah, that was because I was still fairly new. You know, I'd only been in squadron now for, you know, 5-6 months, and yeah, I'm like, holy cow, this dude's hard as woodpecker lips. I mean, no kidding. Yeah, just amazing individual.
So, So just a little background on Tora Bora itself for people who might not know exactly what it is. It's a cave complex in the Spingarh mountain range in eastern Afghanistan. So it's right on the border with Pakistan, right?
Before we get back to Caldwell, I would like to talk to you about this week's sponsors for this podcast. All active or retired military, were you diagnosed with tinnitus or hearing loss after using 3M's dual-ended earplugs? These earplugs were yellow and black or yellow and olive. They were often called Christmas lights. Instead of protecting your hearing, they actually permitted damaging sounds to get through. If you were issued these earplugs while in service and then diagnosed with tinnitus or hearing loss, then call 800-567-8936 because you may qualify for significant cash compensation. Again, if you served in the military and were issued 3M dual-ended yellow and dark earplugs and were later diagnosed with hearing loss or tinnitus, then call 800-567-8936 right now to see if you qualify for cash compensation. 3M knew of the defects but failed to warn anyone about them. A whistleblower lawsuit that 3M quietly settled made the case that 3M manipulated test results to make it appear as if the plugs met government standards, but they didn't. So if you were in the military anytime from 2003 through 2015 and are now suffering from diagnosed hearing loss or tinnitus, then please call 800-567-8936 right now. The lawsuit is against 3M and not the government or the military, so your benefits with the VA will not be affected. Here's the phone number one last time so you can get it. 800-567-8936. Our second sponsor for this week's podcast is Keeps. Two out of three guys will experience some form of male pattern baldness by the time they're 35. The good news, with today's advancements in science, Keeps offers proven treatments that can help combat the symptoms of hair loss. Prevention is key. Keeps treatments really work. They're up to 90% effective at reducing and stopping further hair loss. The sooner you start using Keeps, the more hair you'll save. So act fast. Many men even experience hair regrowth with Keeps treatments. Find out why Keeps has more 5-star reviews than any of its competitors, and nearly 100,000 men trust Keeps for their hair loss prevention medication. Keeps treatments start at just $10 a month, plus for a limited time, you can get your first month free. If you're ready to take action and prevent hair loss, go to keeps.com/globalrecon to receive your first month of treatment for free. That's keeps.com/globalrecon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. It borders right on Pakistan. It is hollowed ground. I mean, that's where they fought the Russians off for years up in that mountain range, and they've got, you know, lots of different, you know, caves, and, you know, I mean, they were smart. I mean, some of the caves, the way that they would camouflage and the way they would cut limbs down for camouflage, you know, they did everything pretty meticulous. You could tell that, you know, they're survivors up there and they've been through it before. You know, as we would advance through and, you know, take some of that ground, you'd see some of these caves and even the way that they'd have their stoves in there, you know, to cook, and the way that they would put, you know, push the heat out and have it covered so it wasn't giving off signature. There was a lot of thought that went into some of that stuff. It kind of blew me away. But it was some treacherous terrain. I mean, there was quite a few times that I'm walking on some paths that, I mean, if you slipped and fell, you were falling to your death. I mean, just thousands of feet straight down. There was some hairy stuff up there for sure. Yeah.
And then, so you guys were up there and like you had mentioned before in Dalton Fury's book, he goes into a great detail on a lot of this. How long were you guys there? Was it a couple weeks or less than that?
Yeah, it was at the most less than two weeks. It was less than 2 weeks that we were actually up there from the time that we inserted. I don't remember the exact date when we left Bagram, but we left there. I mean, it was a couple days. You know, we had to drive, which we did the drive in one day all the way to JBAD, and that was horrendous. Just the roads weren't necessarily roads. They were nasty, just trying to navigate our way all the way there. Took a full day, and then we overnighted, and, you know, then we moved our way to the schoolhouse at the base of the mountains and spent a few days there, and, you know, then getting into the mountains and then actually up in the mountains and fighting, and then, you know, the process of coming back out too. So yeah, it was overall, I think it was over 2 weeks total, but actually up in the mountains and everything was a little less than that.
So ultimately, you guys basically had them on the run. I believe a lot of them did end up surrendering. A lot were killed, and then other people just fled, which I think most people assume into Pakistan, including bin Laden.
Yeah, he snuck out that backside. And it's, you know, it's all in the book, but it's, I mean, it was basically, we were bombing the crap out of him. Bin Laden was injured. We had hit him, you know, with some stuff, and, they got smart, and they basically said, hey, you know, they came across the radios and said, hey, if you give us a so many hour window of, you know, just ceasefire, and they were going to send, you know, like 3,000 troops down through the valley that were going to, you know, surrender and blah, 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 blah. And, we there on the ground were like, hell no,
Right.
We're going to continue this fight because we're kicking your ass, but higher above us. So I don't even know how high it ended up going, but they're like, okay, you know, they got 2 hours, I think it was, that they gave them. So we stopped everything. And, you know, of course, at 1 hour and 59 minutes, at that point, we had maybe seen like 10 dudes that came down through. And right at that 2 hour mark, it was like, you, this is me, fire mission over, and just started annihilating them again. But in that window, it was a bunch that, you know, including bin Laden, that just snuck out the backside into Pakistan.
Right. And I think, wasn't it the Afghan warlord who agreed to that, I think, if I remember correctly?
There was multiple. So in that area, you know, we worked with one particular warlord, tribal chief, but there were others in that area. They had always had intermingled, you know, fighting between the different warlords in that area. So I believe it was one of the other warlords that, you know, and for those guys, it was all about who paid them more money. That was right. Really it. I mean, you know, we came in and we found one that we thought was trusted. We paid him a ton of money to get what we needed. But if, you know, the Taliban had come in behind us and paid him more money, that dude would have slit our throats in our sleep. You know, I mean, they didn't care. They had no loyalties to anybody. It was all about money and what you were giving them. That was it.
Right. And I think a lot of people on the outside looking in don't understand how some of the dynamics of that environment work.
Yeah, that sums it up. And it's because, you know, if you think about it, you know, they have nothing. You know, they're dirt farmers out there. You know, they live off the land, they have whatever land they have. And, you know, the smarter ones rise to the top, become tribal chiefs, warlords, you know, and control an area and have a bunch of minions underneath them. And, you know, they beg, borrow, and steal for everything they got. When somebody comes in, you know, with a heavy pocket, and they just see, okay, I can make my life and my living better. Sure. What do you want? You know, I'll do whatever you want. That's, you know, it's the old, I mean, Wild Wild West, you know, I mean, it's every man for himself out there.
Right. Okay. I also wanted to talk to you about leadership, good leadership versus bad leadership. I'm sure it's something that you've seen throughout your career. Can you give examples of both?
Yeah, it's, I mean, obviously I would say very fortunate. I mean, I worked for everything I had to get where I was, but, you know, coming in initially to Ranger Battalion, you know, you're already coming in with guys that have volunteered numerous times to be there. So they want to be there. You know, so there's, you know, great leadership throughout, you know, Ranger Battalion. I had some great, people immediately above me, you know, E5s that you know, would push me and mentor me, and, you know, all the way up to, I mean, I remember, you know, some great, even company commanders, you know, that were good. And, I really been fortunate because I haven't been in, you know, seen too much, you know, bad leadership. I mean, okay. You get a guy here and there,
right?
Everywhere, but, you know, I hate to say it, you know, but you see a lot of that in the bigger army. And you know, some of those places where you get guys that don't really want to be there, you know, being in Ranger Battalion and then again, then going to the unit. I mean, everybody wants to be there. And if you're not cutting the mustard, I mean, you're gone. You know, that's the nice thing about, you know, even Ranger Battalion is, you know, we call it RFS, but you know, you relief for standards. If you're not meeting the standards, and you're not pulling your weight, then see ya. Yeah, right. Needs of the army, you're gone. And there were, you know, there was a lot of people I saw that, you know, that got released. We had basically a whole platoon in the headquarters company that was the RFS platoon that, you know, once they didn't meet the standards either, whether it was PT standards or, you know, just personal things, that they were gone. They pulled them out of there just so they wouldn't, you know, contaminate anybody else. They were put in their own platoon and, you know, they did their own thing until their orders came to go elsewhere. But, you know, as far as just good examples, you know, I can recall, you know, prior to me being a team leader, you know, at the unit, you know, had other team leaders that were there. I mean, the team leader that I worked under was a great dude. You know, one of the other team leaders that I was in the troop together with was a great guy. And, you know, I remember going into planning sessions with them and watching the way that they would break down like a target. You know, we'd get imagery, and you know, most of the time when we're overseas, you get handed information and it's like, okay, here you go. It's the first time you're seeing it, you know, because this guy just went to this location. We know he's here. So boom, here's the setup, here's the location. We're out of the door, you know, we're leaving in less than 30 minutes. So what are we doing? And you know, to watch these guys break this down and just say, okay, you know, hey, A team, you're going here, B team here, C team here. I need an aircraft to land here, here, here. You know, we have the pilots in there and they'd go, yep, I can put one there. Yep, I can put one there, or I can't put one there, but I can put it here, or, you know, we could fast rope there. I mean, just knowing everything and the experience and watching them break it down, was amazing to me. You know, I mean, I was like, that's what I want to be like, you know, and I would go into every one of those sessions and just learn, you know, from them. And then, you know, I felt like once I made that jump and then, you know, became a team leader, that, you know, that was my strong suit, was we would get, you know, we'd get a target and it was like, okay. And I'd jump right up there and go, okay, boom, boom, boom. Here's what I want. You know, I need guys here, here, this and that. And pilots, you know, would give me the okay or not, whether they could put them there. And that was it. We were out the door. You know, I wasn't big on planning. I didn't like it to sit and do any type of elaborate plan because it was always going to change when you hit the ground. So all I needed to know was where the aircraft could put me and then which team had, you know, which entryway. And that was it. We'll figure it out, you know, when we get there and adjust as you know, as we hit the ground and we see it. But, you know, those guys were immediate, you know, great example, you know, leadership examples for me. It was just the way that they did that. And then everybody else in that building is just amazing. You know, you've got guys that, you know, that are excel at, you know, shooting, whether, you know, some guys are just, hey, these dudes, I mean, this guy, they're amazing pistol shooters. You know, these guys are awesome at, you know, O course. These guys are awesome rifle shooters. These guys are great at hand to hand. You always had certain guys that were just, you know, the top at those little things. And, you know, I would try to, you know, spend time with them. You know, just, hey, you know, what are you doing today? Hey, dude, let's go to the range. Let's go shoot, you know, go shoot with those guys or go run the old course with this guy. And he'll teach me his little tricks on, you know, why he's faster than everybody else, you know, how he's breaking down the obstacles and, you know, all these little things. So it's neat. You know, advice wise, you know, for different listeners out there, you know, I'm sure everybody's seen it and it, you know, may not be military. You know, maybe you're a cook at a restaurant. And, you know, you're a fry cook, but you want to do more. And, you know, you've got this guy that's the grill dude and he's awesome on the grill. I mean, put in the time and go pick his brain, you know, go work a shift with him on the grill. You know, I mean, just let him mentor you. So everybody knows and sees examples of other people in their life that are great leaders or great at something. And, you know, my advice would just be, you know, go after that. I mean, he's great at something because he puts in the time and the effort. You know, he has tricks and techniques to make him better. So go learn what those are. You know, go spend time with that person and be better, you know, at that skill, you know, and make yourself well-rounded by doing that with a bunch of other people, just to be better, you know, at a lot of stuff.
So looking at the previous 18 years of war in Afghanistan, which you were there at the beginning of it, and elsewhere, you know, there are positives from the experiences, from a military perspective. You know, we're talking about medicine and the improvement there. There are a record number of troops surviving wounds from the battlefield that previously these type of wounds were not survivable. So that's a good thing. And then the skill set and ability of guys like yourself, who are constantly deploying and learning how to fight better and things like that, and how to think through problems and stuff like that. So those are positives. Now I wanted to ask you, from a personal perspective and from a bigger picture perspective, do you think it's been worth it?
Oh yeah, it's been, I mean, huge. Just, you know, you touched on a medical piece of it, and you know, what I saw from, you know, pre-war and being in Ranger Battalion, you know, everybody, it was like everybody had a job and you focused on being the best at your job, but we didn't do much cross training. When I got to the unit, cross training was like, you know, no, everybody needs to know, you know, a lot more than just whatever your job is, you know, especially because, you know, as an assaulter, you know, or an operator on a team, every team is different. You have certain little, you know, like I was on a water team for a while, and then I was on a mobility team for a while. So we have a team task, but then inside the team, you know, you've got your team leader and two IC, and then, you know, you're going to have somebody that designated as a breacher. Somebody's gonna be a team medic, team combo guy, but it's just an additional duty. You know, obviously if you get a guy that was an 18 Delta, prior to, then it just makes sense for him to be the team medic, but everybody is a team medic. I mean, everybody learns, you know, our medics, they do a lot of training. I mean, our medics are unbelievable. And, we do a lot of training with them individually as groups, a lot of different scenarios. And everybody becomes a medic. You know, the combo stuff, I mean, yeah, I, you know, came from a combo background, but you know, when I got there, now, you know, I was an operator, so I wasn't doing any combo stuff, but it just made sense for me to be the team combo guy. You know, what did that mean? Really, it didn't mean much. I mean, now I just took our team radios to the combo guy and said, "Hey, combo guy, fill my stuff," which they hated. No. We got along great, because I would keep up on a lot of it. And it actually ended up, you know, working in my favor. Back up a little bit, but you know, one of the times that we were in Afghanistan, we got tasked, we had to go get some information or something from a SF team that was out, in, like, I think they were near Jalalabad or something. Well, my team leader was going out there, but I had to go with him because we had to set up like a fairly elaborate communication system, you know, satellite communications, just doing some different stuff, shooting messages back and data. And, you know, obviously nobody else on the team knew how to do that. I'm like, yeah, I can do that. That's easy. So, you know, here, me as a new guy on the team, I got to go out, you know, with just my team leader on, you know, on a little side mission, just him and I, just because of the skill set that I brought. But, you know, the advancements that we've seen, because of this, you know, the long war and everything, is just amazing. I think it's been nothing but a plus, you know, for the military overall, for the, you know, for the United States. I mean, technology advances that we've had, you know, in equipment, you know, for the military, that has trickled over to the civilian world.
Yeah.
The advancements in weaponry, the advancements in optics, you know, the communication stuff, the medical stuff, you know, is huge. You know, like I said, and you touched on, the number of lives now that are being saved on the battlefield is huge compared to previous wars. And that's because, not only because of the technology advancements, but because of all the cross training that everybody's doing. You know, everybody's learning how to treat wounds.
Right.
So that immediate trauma, which, you know, if you look at the statistics on you know, a guy getting injured in the in battle on the battlefield, that first like 30 minutes is the most critical time. And being able to do the right treatment right away, you know, on somebody is the difference maker for the next 24 hours, you know, of his life.
Right.
So yeah, being able to have everything that we've got now and all the cross training, it's huge. I mean, absolutely huge and a major benefit for us.
And there's several books out there about it, and I don't know how much you can talk about it, but particularly in Iraq and particularly with the unit, once they had like cell phone towers set up and people were using phones in Iraq, then there was more intelligence, and you need intelligence to hit targets and stuff like that. And then there was just what's been described as like a blazing fast cycle of getting information, hitting targets, getting people, and basically breaking up these terrorist networks before they can rebuild. And that's something that's been attributed to the unit and obviously a lot of support personnel as well. And you were part of some of that?
Oh yeah. I mean, I saw a lot of changes in technology from the beginning. I mean, in the very beginning, it was all human, you know, human intelligence. So we were relying on sources and, you know, people that walked in and, you know, gave information. Now, obviously they didn't just walk into us, but, you know, we had our own network, you know, we had people that were out, you know, running sources, and you tap into, you know, other government agencies that we work with, to get intel. But yeah, it was slow in the beginning, but then once, you know, all the technology advancements go and, you know, we're, you know, getting more drones and, you know, predators and all that stuff, where now we're, you know, our camera footage and being able to watch targets, you know, continually, you know, days and weeks at a time, and individuals, and see them moving around and know where they are. I mean, it's all the stuff, you know, you see a lot of it in the movies now, but I mean, that stuff was huge for us to be able to be, you know, 100% accurate on who we were going after, that was the person, where exactly they were, and, you know, to be able to hit there. Because, you know, early on, there's a lot of dry holes we hit, you know, dry hole being, you know, you think that the person is there, you go to that house and nobody's home, you know, versus, hey, that dude's there, we know he's there, we saw him walk into his house, he's still in his house, nobody's left, boom, we go there, he's there, we got him, you know, we're done. So it's, technology aspect for targeting has been huge, really big.
And throughout your career, particularly in combat, did you have a lot of experience working with other units, or even allied nation militaries?
Yeah, we would. I would say probably the most we worked with was the SAS.
Right.
And those dudes, I absolutely love them. I mean, I worked with them quite a bit through my career and built some good relationship with those guys. I still keep in contact with a chunk of them. And it's, yeah, they are phenomenal. I mean, our unit was based off of their model and them. And, you know, the only difference between us and them is technology, really. You know, because of the advancements in the United States with night vision tubes and lasers and different stuff, you know, we've got some better companies here, than they have access to. And it's just goes into, you know, different international trade regulations and things. But, you know, our equipment overall is better than theirs. But as far as people go and actual, you know, soldiering and troops, I mean, they are awesome. They are unbelievable. Yeah, they are great guys to work with, for sure.
So now I would like to talk about your transition out of the military, how it was for you. We can talk about 1 Minute Out, and that's a company that you run. So can we talk about some of that?
Yeah. So I got out December 14, and you know, after 21 years and obviously, you know, 14 years of that pretty much being, you know, combat, you know, I wanted to just walk away from it all.
Okay.
You know, I needed a break. And, you know, I've always been into fishing since I was a kid. You know, I grew up fishing, enjoyed it. When I got stationed in Savannah, Georgia, I really got into bass fishing and then started doing competitive bass fishing with tournaments and everything. And it kept growing, and my passion for it kept growing and growing. It got hard to compete, between all the deployments and everything, but I still made it work. And I actually saw this as a possible retirement plan.
Okay.
And that was my plan. I mean, when I was getting close to retirement, I mean, I started professionally bass fishing. So sponsors, you know, boat sponsor, motor, electronics, rods, reel, you know, everything, truck and boat wrap. I mean, I was fishing at a professional level, you know, my last couple years while I was still in, and I pretty much walked, you know, when I retired out of the military, I went straight, you know, full time, professional bass fishing and saltwater. I competed with the Under Armour fishing team. Under Armour was a big sponsor of mine for years. And, I competed on the Under Armour fishing team on the King Mackerel side. We did the Mercury Pro Trail and the FKA stuff, but I mean, we won a bunch and, you know, did real well. And, you know, and I was doing well on the bass side. And I still do. I don't saltwater fish competitively anymore. It just got to be a lot. I mean, I was traveling a lot between doing the both. So I still bass fish. I still competitively bass fish, still, you know, run around with my boat wrapped and, you know, I've got, which is pretty cool. Cause you know, with the contacts and everything I've made, you know, in the military, I've got some really good companies that back me, you know, on the fishing side.
Nice.
So like, you know, Black Rifle Coffee Company, a lot of people know who they are.
Right.
But you know, they're a big sponsor of mine. Multicam, sponsor of mine, CNG Holsters, you know, they're a sponsor of mine. So bringing some of that, you know, tactical, industry, Oakley, you know, everybody knows Oakley Standard Issue, that type of stuff, you know, they take care of me. So I've built some good relationships, to do that, but I also, you just can't get away from it. You know, the whole tactical piece. I work with a company called Core Survival. We do some helmet strobe lights, so making some tactical strobes, and we do some other different lighting stuff for like jumping, for DZ, setup. So I work with them, and then kind of through that, you know, being at some of the different shows, meeting a lot of SWAT guys, and just their need for training, you know, conversations would go to, you know, yeah, we need to get some training. They don't, you know, they just don't have it. They don't have the budget for it a lot of times, or the ammo, but, you know, the guys want it and need it. And then the more guys I ran into SWAT teams that have night vision or looking to get night vision and just have no idea how to use it. That's sort of where, you know, some of this came from with, you know, with my company with 1 Minute Out. I started 1 Minute Out, as a few things, I guess. It was a message, you know, initially that I wanted to push. You know, 1 Minute Out is kind of about, you know, living like you're 1 Minute Out. You know, when we're inserting in on target and you're 1 minute out from target, you get that 1 minute call, you know, that's kind of when you flip the switch. You know, we're smoking and joking up to that point on the aircraft, you know, going in on target. But at 1 minute, you know, everybody kind of flips that switch, you know, you're firing at 100%, you know, your senses are up. I mean, you're ready to go, right? You are at your prime. And, you know, just trying to tell that message with, you know, with 1 minute out is, you know, live like you're 1 minute out. That point, you know, be like that all the time, you know, be at 100%, you know, be on your game, all your senses firing, be aware of your surrounding, you know, the whole thing. So started 1 minute out, you know, as sort of given that message, and, you know, it's my tactical company also. So now, you know, I'm doing tactical training, do, you know, some rifle pistol stuff. And, you know, the big part of it is night vision training. I run multiple NVG courses throughout the country, every year. And it's all been closed courses for government and LE only. I've got a course coming up in November in, Dallas that is going to be an open enrollment. So civilians can come. It's, you know, there's a little bit of a vetting process. I mean, I'm not just, you know, we're not going to allow just any Joe that's right off the street. You know, we'll talk to you a little bit, figure out what, you know, what you've been through courses already. You know, and you got to have your own equipment. I don't have anything to rent, at this point, but the goal is to, you know, to get a bunch of my own equipment so guys can just show up and go through the course, you know, and rent the equipment too. But, yeah, November in Dallas will be the first open enrollment, NVG course that I'll be teaching. But we go through, you know, a little bit of PowerPoint, just kind of teaching guys what night vision is, you know, and then we go through the equipment, everybody's equipment, make sure that they're, you know, they know how to use it, functions, you know, they're comfortable with it. And we'll go out on the range in the day and do some different rifle and pistol drills, just make sure everybody's comfortable. And, you know, I'm good that everybody's, you know, knows how to handle their weapons and is familiar with all their stuff before we go and roll into the night, you know. And then we'll go through the night stuff and we'll do, you know, some night vision work, rifle, pistol. We'll do, you know, white light stuff with rifle and pistol, just different transitions, you know, and depending on the venue, if they have a shoot house, you know, we'll get into a little bit of some room clearing type stuff, under nods. But it's pretty good. I mean, I've been doing it for a couple of years now and had some really good feedback from it. And it's fun to do, for sure. And we'll see, hopefully it'll continue to grow and expand. But yeah, so that's kind of been my transition out is running 1 minute out, working for Core Survival and doing the professional bass fishing gig. And, yeah, it's not bad. I'm not complaining. I had a great career and now I'm out, busy, but you know, doing what I want to do, doing what I love and having fun.
So if there's anyone listening, either law enforcement or civilians, and they're interested in maybe taking a course or getting in contact with you, where can they do that?
Yeah, you can go to 1MinuteOut.com. So the number one, 1MinuteOut.com is my website. I've got some swag stuff on there too, some shirts and patches and stickers and stuff. But the course information is on there under training courses. You can hit me up on my social media. Instagram's probably the best. You can message me on there and I can send you, you know, info to where to find the stuff. Or some of the course information is also on emergingtacticalsolutions.com. So Pat Hickox is a guy that I hooked up with a couple years ago through Core Survival. He's a prior military, law enforcement, and he's been running NVG courses for quite a few years now, all around the country. So him and I partner up on a handful of courses throughout the year, and he'll have all the different stuff and information on his site. Plus he's got a lot of gear. So if guys are looking for night vision, you know, looking for strobes, like if they're looking to buy one of the Core Survival Hellstar strobes, they can get that stuff on his website. Yeah, nods and lasers, all kinds of different stuff, weapon sights and lights. He carries it all. Sort of a one-stop shop there, but that's emergingtacticalsolutions.com.
Awesome. So it was great to actually get to speak to you and sit down and do this and walk through some of your career a little bit. I know the audience is going to appreciate it. Again, for people who are interested in getting a fuller picture of Tor Bora, they can pick up Dalton Fury's book, Kill Bin Laden. And, you know, like I said, it was great to talk to you. And I just want to thank you for doing this and thank you for your service as well.
Yeah, thanks, John. I appreciate it, man. Thanks for having me on. I'm glad we got to put it together. And, yeah, man, I hope guys like it. And definitely reach out to me. Hit me up on social media. And even if you know, listen to the podcast, just hit me up. Tell me that you heard it. And, yeah, hopefully we do it again soon.